Welcome to a special edition of the Marketplace Roundtable podcast featuring Jay Mintzmyer of Value Investor's Edge. Jay first began contributing to Seeking Alpha in 2011, building up a large following through his work covering shipping stocks, probably about as comprehensively as they're covered anywhere online or in print. Since 2015, Jay has run the Value Investor's Edge Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. The service offers intensive coverage of deep value opportunities in the shipping, energy, MLP, and industrial sectors. You can subscribe to Value Investor's Edge by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Jay Mintzmyer, that's Mintzmyer, or Value Investor's Edge into the search bar at the top of the site. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Seeking Alpha is a website where authors from around the world share their ideas and analysis on the stock market. The Marketplace is our platform for authors to run investing analysis and idea services so that readers can take their investing to the next level. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. And now your host, Jay Mintzmyer.
Good morning, everyone. Good afternoon if you're joining us from Europe. We're starting another iteration of Value Investor's Edge Live, recording on 17 November 2020 at about 9 a.m. Eastern. We're hosting Ardmore Shipping, stock symbol ASC, to discuss the product tanker markets, specifically the subsegment of MRs and some chemical tankers. We're joined by CFO Paul Tivnan, who will discuss the company strategy and capital allocation, as well as the overall markets. Paul, welcome. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Jay, and thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Just some quick disclaimers before we begin. Nothing on the call this morning constitutes official company guidance or investment recommendations of any form. I do have long exposure to Ardmore Shipping. Keep in mind this is being recorded on 17 November 2020, so if you listen on a later date, make sure you get those updated disclosures. Paul, again, welcome. Let's just jump right into it. Let's talk about the product tanker market. Obviously, a little bit of a roller coaster this year. Current rates have been lackluster, but we are approaching, normally where the season where we get a little bit of an uptick here in November. What is kind of the overall state of the product tanker market? Is there any optimism for sort of a winter kind of a refinery switching push like we normally get, or are we still just kind of stuck in destocking for the next few months?
Great question, Jay. I think, look, in shipping, it's a volatile business, so you have to be optimistic if nothing else. But I think in this instance, look, there are reasons to be optimistic. And I think when we had our earnings call about 2 weeks ago now, I think what the way we described it was we do expect an uptick over the winter season, but not a typical winter market. I think the demand destruction caused by the pandemic is still there. But in terms of optimism, look, you got to look at our business demand coming from three areas. The first one is oil consumption. The second one is voyage length. And the third one is trading activities. Looking at oil consumption, oil demand is consumption is continuing to recover. Jet fuel demand is the biggest component, maybe not necessarily for shipping, but it's the biggest component of demand that's missing. And that's about 5 million barrels a day. Demand for the fourth quarter is up quarter on quarter, so that's trending in the right direction. I was talking to our Singapore office this morning. Parts of Asia are back to normal. Flights are resuming and travel resuming from Singapore to China to Hong Kong, but the US and Europe are lagging and increased cases in COVID. So on the demand side, I think you're seeing more activity in the east. The west is definitely struggling, and you can even see that not just in the shipping markets, but you can see it in the broader economy. Meanwhile, refined product inventories are drawing. Refineries are underproducing relative to demand, so stocks are coming down heavily. We're below the peaks, so that's good. And then I suppose the biggest cause for optimism is in voyage distances and what's happening on the refinery space. The closure of small refineries has really accelerated over the past few months. The IEA forecasting 1.7 million barrels a day to be closed over the next 12 months. And in our presentation, we said 2.5 million barrels a day over the next 3 years. But I think either way, it's quite a lot of refinery capacity coming off. The U.S. accounts for the vast majority of that. Big refinery in Philly, which everybody will know, the 335 barrel a day refinery is closed and is now sold for real estate. Wood Mackenzie have 11 refineries closing in Europe. In Australia, all four refineries are closing. And at the same time, you've got massive projects coming online in the Middle East and Asia, which we highlighted on our call. So I think, we've got a current headwinds, I would say, in terms of oil consumption demand as a consequence of the pandemic. But on the refinery side and product tanker ton-mile demand, I think it's real cause for optimism. And you'll see that play out over the next couple of months. And I suppose the last piece of tanker demand is trading activity. And that's been quiet over the past couple of months. But as we know, tankers can be wildly volatile. Right now, the oil market is oversupplied. Oil supply is increasing. Libya's output is increasing. And the OPEC compliance has been good, but they're set to increase their oil production by 2 million barrels a day at the start of the year. Unless, of course, the meeting later this month that they decide to curtail it. But I think to kind of summarize the point, I think oil consumption is recovering. It will continue to recover into 2021. Voyage distances and refinery dislocation is a real cause for near-term optimism and kind of more medium-term optimism. And then trading activity is the wild card. Hopefully that can surprise to the upside. But I think broadly, would expect a small uptick from here, but I wouldn't expect a traditional, strong winter market given the disruption and as associated with the pandemic.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. We won't get our hopes up too much yet. It sounds like, of course, the refinery shift is going to lead to a boost in ton miles, right, per the same amount of global demand. Is there any sort of, I don't know if you've done any internal studies or you have referenced maybe some external studies, but is there any sort of percentage to that you expect? Because, I mean, just say we hold demand flat. Obviously, we hope demand increases because it's artificially low because of COVID. But let's say we hold demand flat and we say that, by the end of 21, we're sort of back to like the end of 19 comparably. What sort of impact do you expect from the ton mile shift? Do you have a number on that or an estimate?
Yeah, I'll talk in broad terms because there's a lot in it. So you've got barrels of cargo, what's the actual amount of cargo that's moving at sea, and then you've got voyage distances. And of course, voyage distances, in a simple sense from A to B is easy, but given the nature of trading activity, sometimes our ships will leave Houston and go to the middle of the Atlantic and then get voyage and delivery instructions anywhere from Scandinavia right down to West Africa. So the voyage distances can vary. But looking purely at cargo moving at sea, the market very broadly for product, seaborne product, is about 22 million barrels a day. So that's the market of seaborne volumes of refined products. And if you take offline 2 million barrels a day of refinery capacity in Europe and the US, and that's replaced with export capacity in the Middle East and Asia, very simply, you're potentially adding, anywhere between 1 and 2 million barrels a day of increased cargo volumes moving at sea, allowing for some of the stuff that would have been produced and consumed domestically. But that's anywhere between 5 and 10% increased volumes moving at sea over the next kind of 12 to 24 months. That's very broad numbers. It's very hard to kind of pinpoint that there's some winners, some losers, but it is meaningful in terms of a market of 22 million barrels a day to be moving. Instead of moving 2 million barrels of crude into a refinery, you're now moving the best part of 2 million barrels a day of refined products to end consumers. So it is material, but the impact that can have, whether it be 5 or 10%, it's hard to estimate.
Sure. I appreciate you, diving into that a little bit, Paul. I know it's difficult to estimate and nail those down exactly, but just so we have an idea of kind of the percentage shift to focus on, obviously jet fuel demand has plummeted into 2020. It's recovering a little bit, but we're still significantly below. I think it's about 40% or 50% below what it was last year. In terms of the jet fuel impact on the product tanker market, can you just briefly walk us through that again as well? I know it's about 6 to 8% of the global petroleum market, but how much does that impact your actual trade?
Yeah, it's a small component, and I don't know the exact numbers in terms of it, but it's a feature of the market, but definitely not as large as kind of gasoline, gas oil, naphtha, etc. So it's probably maybe 10 to 15% of the overall refined product seaborne market, and you've taken away maybe half of that. So again, you can see, for example, Asia is now back to normal, you know, in a good few countries, whereas in the West where we are, in Europe and the US, it's not back at all. Jet fuel inventories are surprisingly not that high. So it is, you know, they're underproducing, they're using jet fuel for other uses. So it's finding its way through the market. But no, I would say it's definitely having a couple of percent impact on the product tanker market.
Yeah, certainly. And of course, you know, we're talking about shipping companies and shipping economics where, you know, 5% change on either supply or demand can have just a massive impact on rates. So it's not too surprising, considering that, you know, 40% of the jet fuel's offline, just napkin math. But let's say that's like 5 or 6% of your seaborne products, then we're talking about a massive negative impact until that comes back. So we're hoping that it'll be back in, you know, mid to late 21, but obviously it'll be something for us as investors and you as a company to watch. Let's talk a little bit about more specifically at Ardmore, your capital allocation priorities and things you're doing now to address some of the huge disconnects, for example, in your stock price, but also keeping the company, stable in terms of leverage and liquidity. So what are your priorities today? Let's kind of rehash those. I know you talked a little bit on the conference call, but just a rehash and maybe an update, because I know last summer you put out kind of a new policy, right? Where you said your number one policy was delevering, and then you would consider, you know, other things later. I think it was like delevering number one, grow the fleet, modernize number two, and then maybe like shareholder returns once those two have been accomplished. Can you update us a little bit now on where you sit?
Yeah, no, that's like, this is, capital allocation, it's a great topic. And quite honestly, we're glad that everybody is focused on it. And I think, you know, we're probably one of, if not the only shipping company with a very kind of transparent and well-articulated capital allocation policy. You know, we're the only ones that actually have a capital allocation policy, which is publicly available. So in shipping or in any asset owning business, it's probably the most important decision that you can make in terms of shareholder value. And it's something we spend an enormous amount of kind of time and effort analyzing and thinking about. So I guess to start off, let's be clear, our priorities on long-term shareholder value. And that means protecting the equity value and also building equity value. And in order to accomplish that, this requires balancing short-term decisions and long-term decisions. So when we invest in a ship, it's a long-term decision. You're buying an income-generating asset with potential for appreciation, asset appreciation. Now, the ship that we bought in August was a 27% discount to a depreciated new build, but an extremely low break-even. You know, we didn't buy that for 2 or 3 months. We bought that for, you know, potentially 3 years or so. And we think that over that period of time, we'll make good money, and this is an opportune time. As a company, we're very focused on balance sheet strength and delevering. And that, for us, is a way to protect the equity value that's there and also build long-term value. You know, we've seen lots of examples of prioritizing, short-term value over long-term value. And we believe that long-term balance sheet strength and delevering is the way to protect the equity. Now, in the short term, we are open to altering the priorities, you know, to market circumstances. And we've been clear on this. Our share price, it moves around a lot. We've traded at a premium to NAV, and now we're trading at a steep discount to NAV. And generally, the steep discounts are short-term in nature. But I think what we've seen over the past couple of months, given the pandemic, is that all shipping stocks have been depressed. And as a consequence, we've altered our priorities and made our intention to engage in buybacks. But, you know, going back to the capital allocation priorities, you know, longer term, they remain the same. It's delevering and it's investing in our business and investing in income generating assets and improving the business. And then in the short term, you know, where there are disconnects or you know, real periods of opportunity, which we think are taking longer to correct themselves, then you know, we got to alter our priorities accordingly. And that's why we've signaled our intention to engage in buybacks this quarter.
Yeah, thanks for kind of building to that segue, Paul, in terms of talking about buybacks. So you have a 30 million, you know, share buyback program, but at the same time, you know, operating cash flow is very pressured, right? It's a weaker market. The balance sheet is not super high levered, but the leverage is substantial, and the liquidity is smaller. So is this $30 million program, is this something that you believe you can afford to utilize, let's say in the next, you know, 6 months or so, or is this a very long-term aspirational sort of target?
I think, look, the program itself is we had a $25 million program, which expired in August. So the announcement of the new program in September, we increased it because we figured it was over the next 3 years more likely to use more of it. But the program itself will last, the approval lasts for 3 years. For us, you know, are we going to spend all $30 million over the next kind of quarter? So no, that is unlikely. I think for us, it goes back to the last point, which is balancing long-term and short-term priorities. And too often, at least in my experience, and I'm sure many people on the call will have seen companies that focus on the short-term only. They buy back stock to send a signal or to, you know, and all of a sudden they end up getting in a financial hole. And buybacks themselves have not been very popular over the last 6 months with the Fed or everybody else. Now, you know, we're not Berkshire Hathaway. We don't have 20% of our balance sheet in cash. But, you know, buybacks are a valuable tool in the toolkit. And again, the point I was making, it's a balancing act and there are trade-offs. So can you buy back stock? Do you delever? Or do you choose to invest in new technologies to improve your vessel efficiency or enhance your asset value? And as we kind of telescope out, you know, 12, 24 months and even beyond getting to the zero emission targets, we're at the foothill of enormous change in energy in the shipping sector with enormous opportunity. So when you see this and the trade-offs and, you know, you're balancing short-term and long-term, you know, there's no set number, I guess, in terms of what we plan to spend on share buybacks or when we plan to spend it. In the past, we have expressed frustration about the inability to buy back stock in any great volumes, and that's purely down to SEC limitations. You know, they're there for everybody to see how you can buy, when you can buy. You know, you can't buy in an uptick, you can't buy the first trade, the last trade. So with a company of our size, it is hard to do, you know, really big buybacks for obvious reasons. So if you wanted to do something meaningful, you'd have to do a, you know, a tender offer. That's obviously an option. But I would say that more likely we'll continue to kind of focus on the trade-offs and continue to engage in share buybacks, you know, where it makes sense. And if there's daylight on rates and, you know, there's a potential to invest in something which has really high returns, then, you know, it might be a better use of capital somewhere else. So for us, it's a trade-off. You know, we do appreciate balancing short-term and long-term priorities. And that's why I guess we altered our capital allocation priorities, you know, over the last quarter or so.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the past, that it's difficult to buy back meaningful quantities of shares. And, you know, it sometimes depends on where the shares trade and how big the discount is. But, you know, at the current market, you know, market hasn't opened yet today. We're recording on November 17th. But, you know, the close of your stock yesterday was 294. And NAV, of course, can change based on broker valuations and estimates and so on. But NAV is in the neighborhood of $6 a share. So you're trading at, you know, 50%, even if you stress test a little bit and you bring that NAV down to like 5, you're trading at a significant discount to NAV. The volume on your shares the last few days has been anywhere from 300,000 to 500,000 shares traded. So even if you only, you know, could use 10% of that volume, you know, you're still talking about several hundred thousand dollars of repurchase every trading day, right? And as you mentioned, you know, the 30 million it's not a one quarter program. Right. Hopefully it's not a 3-year program. Hopefully it's sooner than that if these discounts remain. But it's definitely going to give you some time to work through that. So it seems like there's ample opportunities to buy back basically as much stock as you legally can at these enormous discounts of 50% to NAV. Is there any sort of way to, I mean, you mentioned a tender, right? That's a way to sort of accelerate things if you did say a tender at 350 or 375 or 4 or whatever it might be. What about selling ships? Because there has been some ship sales recently in the market, not a lot, but there's been a dozen or so in the last couple of months, and they're fairly close to quoted NAV. So they're proving that NAV is real. It's not just a mirage. Is it possible to sell some ships at, like, you know, the 100% NAV, or maybe you have to take a 5% discount or something for 95%, and then turn that cash around and buy back your stock at a 50% discount? Wouldn't that grow your long-term returns on a per share basis a lot faster?
Yeah, I mean that comes up a lot. Quite honestly, why don't you sell ships and buy back stock? And again, that brings me back to these are long-term decisions versus short-term decisions. I'm selling a ship and I'm foregoing, you know, future income to buy back stock today. It's definitely an option. I'm not going to argue with the theory of it. I would say, And companies have done that, and some companies have done it successfully. Obviously, you know, we are a business, so you can't obviously sell your entire fleet and do that, because that becomes a different strategy, and then you've given up all hope on the business. I think for us, we think given the outlook in the market, you know, get through pandemic, and you can erase that for the moment. But getting through the pandemic and looking at what's happening in the broader shipping space and the energy space between now and 2030, the massive push for carbon reduction and emission reduction is going to transform the shipping industry. And you telescope out about the pace of scrapping that might happen over the next 5 or 6 years. Effectively, you're now, over the next 5 or 6 years, you're going to be starting scrapping all of those ships that were built in the mid-2000s. So the last big shipping boom that we had, you know, the commodity boom, China was flying it in the mid-2000s. You're going to be scrapping those over the next 5 or 6 years. There's going to be, you know, severe restrictions on ships in terms of their emissions, whether you're trading in Europe and you've got, you know, you've got to buy carbon credits, or more broadly, you've got new targets on efficiency and regulations, either through the Sea Cargo Charter or Poseidon Principles, etc. So I guess, you know, long story less long is, I think the winners over the next couple of years will be companies that have modern fuel efficient fleets and that have ships that are well ahead of the targets, because those are ships that will be in high demand. Those are the ships that every charterer will want. And those are the ways that will, you know, give you an opportunity to generate kind of superior returns. Now, the market will always catch up, but we think there's probably a period of time over the next couple of years where there'll be a real kind of tightness in supply of fuel efficient ships for primary markets. And, you know, we've got one of the youngest fleets in the business. Majority of ships were built in 2015. Even the ships that are pre-2013, so the ships that are not eco-designed, you know, we've done our own analysis on those, and those ships will easily meet the new EEXI target. So I guess the point is, you're potentially selling ships that will be very, very valuable in a year or so in a new market and a new kind of more tighter emissions market to buy back stock today. So that makes the decision a little bit more challenging. You know, for older ships that we have, yeah, you're absolutely right. We should probably trim those. One of those is for sale at the moment. We have 106 in the fleet, and we've got 08. So, you know, answer to your question, selling ships to buy back stock, you know, I agree with the theory. But more broadly, I think as we look beyond the pandemic, we think companies like ourselves with very young fleets, you know, they'll be very valuable, and they'll be more valuable. And it probably makes sense to hold on to those. And hopefully those earnings will, you know, we've proven right.
You know, I see the attachment to, you know, the longer term market in products, and I certainly agree that there's a lot of upside, and I agree that those eco ships will probably perform quite well. At least we hope them to perform well, or we wouldn't have invested in Ardmore, right? So we're on the same page in terms of hopes for later into 2021 and into 2022. But I guess the frustrating point, or maybe the point that maybe we're talking past each other a little bit, but shouldn't shareholders care about per share returns and per share allocation of ships? So if you sell a ship, but you immediately deploy those proceeds into repurchasing stock, your ships per share actually go up. So if anything, you're buying more into that same fleet, into that same idea. It's not like it's mutually exclusive, right? I mean, if anything, you're actually investing more money into that theory.
Yeah, I think there's a kind of sweet spot between how many ships you sell and how many shares you buy back. And, you know, what we've seen in shipping is, you know, you're surprised by how quickly these markets correct themselves, and then you'll be sorry that you sold the ships and you didn't have it. So I think, look, we're very attuned to all of those points and the analysis that goes behind it. I've done it many times in terms of selling a ship, buying back stock versus, you know, keeping the ship and what might happen in terms of the charter market up or down. So, you know, I think we'll both agree on the same point that, you know, selling a ship or two to buy back stock is probably a smart thing to do. But likewise, when the market turns, you want to have very good ships and you probably want them in the spot market. So, you know, I think we're broadly agreed on the point. I guess where we're probably not agreed is how many ships you would sell and how much stock you'd buy back in a short period of time.
Yeah, there's always the debate about, you know, share float and how much share liquidity you want. It seems like in the shipping market, really over the last several years, but especially accelerated into 2020, if anything, there's too much shares out there. There's too many companies. There's too many different stocks trading. There's the supply versus demand of the shares themselves is very unhealthy. So it would be good to see some of that slack pulled back in. And look, if there's people out there on the market that are willing to sell to you at 50% NAV, I mean, if people are willing to sell their shares for that, I mean, let's take advantage of it, right? So that's, I think that's the viewpoint of longer term investors is let's exploit this market disconnect. And yeah, we want to keep the ships. Yeah, we want to keep the fleet. But, you know, we're not talking about selling 10 or 15 ships. You know, we're talking about selling one or two or three to bolster the liquidity to a point at which you can take that. So one more question on your sort of liquidity and leverage targets. What do you see as sort of your sort of like free liquidity at this moment? I know you have a facility that you mentioned on your earnings call that you're going to draw down on. You're considering selling one of your ships. How much would you say is it 15 or 20 million that you have to play with, or some sort of rough number that you can give to investors?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we're obviously working on the loan facility, which we have. That's a 10 million facility for the ship we acquired in August. So that will take us about, you know, to around kind of $60 million. Plus or minus towards the end of the year, you know, taking account of where the market is. So I think, look, for us, it's what is your kind of free liquidity? What is the equity in the ships, and what is the market outlook likely to be like over the next kind of 6 months or so? You know, rates today, as we've guided, are quite low. Most companies are probably bleeding a little bit of cash today, so you have to leave a little bit of reserve aside for that. And then you've got your cash covenant. So I think there's a little bit. I'm not going to kind of give you an exact number, Jay. I'm going to be honest, but I think there's, for us, it's a movable target all the time. When the market dips down, you kind of figure, okay, we probably need to, have more cash than we had expected. And you know, if the market takes off again, and you know, get a few more vaccines, and that gets rolled out, then you arguably have loads of liquidity. So I think that's why. You know, people kind of laugh that we're saying it's a balancing act. It is. It's something that you look at every single day. The market levels, break even levels. What's your kind of capex coming up, or what's your break even levels for the next, four quarters or so, and then you make a judgment call as to what's the right thing to do. But for us, we've always, and I think people that know the company, and Jay, you've been following us for quite some time, we do prioritize financial strength. As the number one way of protecting equity value. We don't roll the dice and you know, stick our finger in the air and hope for the best. We do try and make sure that we have enough liquidity both on hand and potential access to liquidity through refinance, etc., to make sure that we are protecting the equity and we do have enough cash to weather any market, whether that's 1 quarter, 2 quarters, 4 quarters, whatever it is. So, you know, I'm not going to give a precise number. Everybody will have a view as to what our excess liquidity is. We do have some. But as you quite rightly pointed out, it would be silly to kind of go through it all.
Yeah, Paul, I guess I'm just asking that question because one of the, you know, common retorts or points made is that you have this $30 million share purchase, which, you know, makes great sense on paper because you trade at 50% NAV. But at the same time, your leverage is higher and your liquidity is smaller. So I think there's been a lot of folks that are skeptical that you're even going to use the buyback at all. And I think you kind of mentioned that on the conference call that, look, we do have some levers to pull. I guess we certainly hope that when we pull up your Q4 results in the end of January or start of February next year, that we do see, right, a significant amount of shares that were repurchased and, you know, at 50% or 55% or whatever it may be of your NAV. You know, it's sort of a tough question for you, but I think one that deserves following up on. Over the summer, you got a buyback or a merger offer with Hafnia, right? And they offered you a ratio of shares. You know, whenever there's like a merger offer with a ratio of shares, it's always talked about in terms of cash, right? Because what is the cash value of the shares at the trading price the day before they made the offer and so on. But it was a ratio of shares, right? Based on a sort of ratio. And if you take that ratio today, in fact, I just did the math, you know, earlier this morning, that would be over $4 equivalent per Ardmore share. Ardmore share trades at $2.97 today. That is, you know, a significant discount to what would have been just over $4 with Hafnia. Hafnia would have given you more scale, right? A larger fleet, more liquidity a stronger balance sheet to negotiate with. What are some of the, I guess, first of all, is there any sort of regret to not going with that proposal? And then secondly, what are some of the justifications for keeping Ardmore still separate as opposed to sort of merging up with a larger company?
Thanks, Jay. Well, look, I think, first off, for a whole host of reasons, and I'm not going to kind of talk about particular, you know, particular transactions. Quite honestly, I can't. What I would say is we are, you know, 100% interest in shareholder value. And, you know, the approach that was made over the summer and the subsequent decision by our board, we spoke to, you know, I spoke to, I'd say, virtually 60% of our investors, because that's the top 20. And the overwhelming response was they fully agreed with it for a whole variety of reasons, of which valuation and currency is one. So, you know, I don't think there's any regret on that decision. It's, you know, we're a listed company in the US. Our stock is traded. You know, it's a fully free float company, and our stock trades in line with our peers. You know, we trade, you know, directly comparable to Scorpio, which is an enormous company with free float. So in terms of our share price performance, it tracks the market. But the broader point is that we are 100% aligned with shareholders, and we are interested in maximizing shareholder value. And if there are ways to maximize shareholder value, and we've looked at everything, you know, we don't look at just the press release. We go into a hell of a lot more detail than that with advisors. And if it's evident that there's a way to improve shareholder value, we will look at it, and our board will make a decision accordingly. So I think, you know, our job is to run the business in the interest of our shareholders. You know, we don't have one arm around the shoulder and one hand in their pocket. We have one arm around our shoulder. We're fully incentivized to get the shareholder and the share price up and build long-term value. And that's what we do. You know, we don't have related party transactions or conflicts of interest. There's only one objective here, and that's long-term shareholder value. So, I don't comment on specific M&A. Our share price is performing in line with others, and you know we're always interested in ideas for sure. If there's opportunities to grow, and Ardmore can be the acquirer or the target, then they're both okay. Whatever is in the interest of long-term shareholders, whatever gets them the best return over the long term. And we've looked. I guess the other point is we've looked at multiple M&A transactions over the years, and the vast majority of them remain in private. And you know, so conversations can happen and die and then come back to life again. So they are unusual to be played out in the public domain.
I mean, obviously, shareholder returns over the long term should be the priority. And, you know, the only yardstick which we can measure by is what the half-year offer was. Now, it's only been a few months, right? We're in a depressed part of the market. You haven't had an opportunity to, you know, execute on that repurchase yet and correct some of those gaps. But that's the only yardstick we have. And right now, the yardstick is $4 if you went with Hafnia, $3 staying by yourself. Yeah, we'll give you some time, but I think we'll have to come back in, you know, maybe next summer, next fall, and we'll have to say, look, what is the differential? And hopefully, right, we were invested in Ardmore for a reason. We like your fleet and we think there's potential, but hopefully that Ardmore stock price in, you know, give it 6 months, give it a year, is higher than that yardstick equivalent, because that is, right, the definition of shareholder returns is eventually, you know, how high does your share price go? How many dividends do you pay? And so on. So we're hoping for the best, but you know, that's kind of the yardstick we're looking at. And right now Ardmore's lagging. We're hoping you'll close that gap. There's an opportunity, right? A very clear opportunity to close that gap, but we need to see that move. One more question on your fleet. There's been a lot of kind of questions with the new environmental regulations. You mentioned it yourself that the differentials between eco ships and the older tonnage are likely to increase significantly in the future. How can we think about your eco mod ships versus your regular eco ships? Are they basically the same, or what is the differential? Because I think there's been a lot of skepticism that those vessels can still compete at the same level.
That's a great question. Look, I think we've been doing this from you know, since 2010. We were the first company to order the Eco Design engines in 2011. We ordered them in 2010, but we upgraded to the electronic engines in 2011. So we were the first to order the new Eco Design ships. But also, when we were looking at kind of second-hand ships, we realized that ships that were built in Japan of a certain vintage were incredibly fuel efficient. They were ahead of their time. And actually, the ship that we just bought in August has, you know, features which were 5 or 6 years ahead of its time in terms of components and the accommodation block and design and all of that good stuff. So I would say look, the proof ultimately will be in the pudding. Okay, because all of these ships, if the EXI regulations are enforced or something similar to those are enforced, you're going to see the various different scores on the ships, and you're going to see which ships had to be, you know, heavy either curtailments on the engine power or heavy retrofits to make them compliant, and then you'll see ships that are easy to comply. And you know, we've done our analysis on the EcoMod ships, and they will comply with absolute ease. And that's a function of the quality of the ship, but also of the amount of time and effort that's been invested in technologies, upgrades, and you know, operating performance and voyage performance. So I think, look, this will prove itself out over time, and I think we're sitting quietly confident here that our fleet are very much compliant. And you can also see that in our, you know, we're one of the few companies that report their carbon emissions quarterly, and we're way ahead of the Poseidon targets, which is effectively the IMO's target. So, and that's right across the fleet. You can see the performance of the MRs and the chemical ships as well. So, I think. Over time, it'd be very obvious if it's not obvious already.
Yeah. What about the chem tankers? You have a few ships that can do chem bulk. Is there a differentiating factor for those vessels? Or is that market basically highly correlated with products? Is it? I imagine it's also depressed at the moment. Is there anything that differentiates those vessels?
I mean, they're historically, those ships have done, you know, they're really more sophisticated product tankers. So they can carry the full range of products plus a full suite of chemical cargoes with exception of acid. So, you know, they can trade in either market, but they spend more time now doing chemicals and veg oils. The chemical market is interesting because it's directly correlated, you know, 98% correlation with global GDP. So you think irrespective of what's happening on the energy transition and oil demand, et cetera, that the chemical market will continue to grow unabated. So I think the outlook for those is slightly different and much more intriguing. And, you know, they've proven themselves. The chemical market has held up quite well over the last couple of months. You can see the performance of our 37,000 tonners and our chemical ships relative to guidance from other companies. So I think we're intrigued by the performance of those ships. And I think that market will continue to do very well as well.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. I appreciate your time today. I think it's been useful. I know we pressured you a little heavily on the buybacks and the sort of the Hafnia comparables. And, you know, that'll, you know, continue to go forward. Of course, we want to see strong capital allocation, but I appreciate you coming here and answering these questions and speaking with shareholders. One sort of closing question, just kind of a simple one. I know you can't, you know, give formal guidance. I know it's kind of up in the air at this point. But based on what you know now, obviously things can change. We're talking about vaccines, but at the same time, we're talking about COVID resurging in the US and Europe. But what is a reasonable timeline for these rates to normalize? Are we talking, you know, early 21, late 21, 2022? What is a reasonable timeline for investors to kind of, you know, put a sticker on their calendar and say, you know, this is the time at which high probability that things will normalize? Do you have any sort of rough estimate? Obviously things change, not holding your feet to the fire on this one, but just something to leave folks with.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I guess you think back, it feels like an eternity ago, but this time last year, the market was getting ready for IMO 2020 and everything's looking great. And tanker market had really picked up and everybody's profitable and it was all looking good. And then the pandemic hit. So I think that's obviously what we're dealing with now, the underlying oil demand, and we think that'll recover. I think you probably will see a different pace of recovery. So I think Asia will recover sooner. You know, as I said, mentioned earlier on, you know, parts of Singapore and China, the travel is back to normal, and the Europe and US will take more time. But as you said, vaccine is potentially the light at the end of the tunnel. So I would say, you know, I'm kind of reading the tea leaves here, looking at the economic data, thinking that the second half of next year will be when the global economy starts really rebounding and starts accelerating from there. But I think the product tanker market and the chemical tanker markets will probably lead that a little bit, because as the economy is opening up and things are starting to take off, no pun intended. I think, you know, there's a lot of repositioning to be done, and refineries will will really ramp up capacity. So I'd like to think as we get into 2021, we'll see an uptick in activity, and then as we get through it, hopefully it'll be we'll track the global economy in terms of kind of accelerating back to where we were. But if you look at Rystad, IEA, all of these oil predictors, they're saying that it'll take until the end of the year for oil demand to kind of get back to where it was. I think given what we're seeing with the refineries and all of that, we probably will hopefully be ahead of that by a fair bit.
All right, so fair enough to say sort of a mid to late 21 is a reasonable target. Is that a fair summary?
I think it'll lift off from where we are, but getting back to 2019 levels, they were good, healthy markets. That might take, the second half of the year. Again, just a rough estimate at this point. But, tankers, as you well know, Jay, they experienced spikes driven by volatility, and who knows what's in store for the winter with OPEC, second waves, vaccine talk, etc. So you always have that spice factor with the tankers.
Absolutely. I mean, just in the last year, we've had like three or four different sort of black swans, right? I mean, we had the Costco sanctions in the fall of last year. We had the IMO 2020 frenzy into January. We had COVID hitting in February and March. We had floating storage. I mean, it's been a wild year and a half. So things can change, and they can also change positively. And we've seen that many times. Hey, Paul, thanks again for joining us and taking our questions. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Not at all. Thanks, Jay, and have a good day.
This concludes another iteration of Value Investor's Edge Live. We hosted Ardmore Shipping, stock symbol ASC, this morning to talk about the product tanker markets. Specifically, their CFO, Paul Tivman, joined us to speak about the company and their capital allocation priorities. I do have a long exposure to Ardmore Shipping. This was recorded on the morning of 17 November 2020. Nothing on this call constitutes official company guidance or investment recommendations in any form.
If you've been enjoying the Seeking Alpha Marketplace Roundtable podcast, you can subscribe through iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Stitcher. You can also give reviews on those platforms to help other investors discover this podcast. Jay Mintzmyer runs the Value Investor's Edge Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. You can subscribe to Value Investor's Edge by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Jay Mintzmyer, that's MINTZMYER, or Value Investor's Edge into the search bar at the top of the site, or by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for Value Investor's Edge there.